Nadie parece nieve.
Dios mío.
Good afternoon. This is the CIS Oral History Research Project of 2008-2009, and we are in New Orleans, Louisiana, researching on April 24th, 2009. My name is Jamesia King.
Elizabeth Alexander.
Alicia Bello.
Chanel Caldwell.
Shannon Palmer.
Christina Resolute.
Sharon Durbin.
And we have Ms. Durbin here today. We will be interviewing her and hearing her story, which we know will be wonderful. So, Ms. Durbin, what's your full name and your birth certificate?
My full name on my birth certificate is Sharon Odile Fletcher.
And where were you born, Ms. Durbin?
I was born in New Orleans, Louisiana, at Charity Hospital.
Okay. And what was it like growing up in New Orleans?
At the time that I grew up in New Orleans, in the beginning, it was highly segregated, which of course, the neighborhood that I was raised in, we were the only blacks in that neighborhood. Everyone else was Caucasians. How that happened, I really don't know, because there were no really mixed neighborhoods.
What part of New Orleans are you from?
Originally, I'm from, they'll call it the Fabre Marigny area now. But at that time, it was just Burgundy between Spain and Manitoba.
And how did growing up in a high segregated neighborhood make you feel? How did that make you feel?
Well, at the time, I was a child, so I didn't feel anything. I mean, I played with all the children in the neighborhood, which were white children. But even as a child, I was inquisitive because I often wondered why they could come over to our house and play, but we could not go over to their house. But being a child, it really wasn't significant. I just wondered why.
What did your parents tell you about growing up and being black?
Basically, my mother did not teach color. She just taught that I could be whatever I wanted to be. And I was equal to anybody in the world. That's what my mother taught. Now, don't get me wrong, she let me know I was a black girl, that I was not Caucasian. But that's basically all my mother said. She never drew on anything else. But back in those days, there were things that predominantly let me know that things were different. Because that's in those days that I was born and raised, you could not sit where you wanted to on the bus. If there was a water fountain or whatever, you could not drink out of it because they had white and colored labeled. And if you would go to a restaurant or something in order to get a sandwich or anything, you had to go through the back window. I remember those things even as a little girl. But they never really deterred anything I wanted to do, because we weren't rich, so therefore we didn't have a lot of money, so I wasn't visiting restaurants, really, no way. But I was made aware that I could not eat and drink and go anywhere I wanted to go. And we were, although we were the only blacks in the neighborhood, I often wondered why I could not go to the neighboring schools, because the school that I was closest to was two blocks from me. But I had to go to a school 12 blocks away. And my mother explained to me that it was because I was black that I could not go to that school. But that's all she said. She did not go into any specifics. I knew I couldn't go to the school down the street from me because it was a Catholic school, and I know my mother didn't have the money. I could understand and accept that better than I could accept not going to the other school, which was all white because it was public. And instead, like I said, you know, I had to go elsewhere, clean out the neighborhood. But then I was a child. So my cares were not that I could go to that school. My only care was whether I was going to have donuts or whatever I wanted the next day. Or was I going to get a baby doll for Christmas? You know, it just didn't matter.
Can you tell us a little bit more about your mother?
My mother was matriotic because she and my father, they separated early in my life. So I really was brought up by a single parent. And my mother worked for a living. She was very, very smart. She really was. But she did not have the proper education because if you thought I was brought up in them times, you know, she had to be brought up in tougher times than those. But she did have a high school education. But she did work in other people's houses and did their cleaning. And then she, for after a while, she got hired in a pharmacist. But she was not hired with a pharmaceutical capacity. She really would clean up, but through that, like I told you, she was very, she really was smart. And my mother really, she grasped a lot of pharmaceutical stuff. My mother actually understood doctor's writing. She knew she could have been a doctor herself, but there was no money or nothing for that. She had three children she had to raise. So, and like I said, she was patriotic. She worked every day. And so we saw our mother at night. And there were times when she worked two jobs and we barely saw her.
What influences did the New Orleans culture have in your upbringing?
Yeah, on my upbringing, it had none. But we had cousins who were raised in the same house, but they had a different experience because they were into the things that New Orleans had offered, like the Indians, Carnival, all the different holidays, the second lines. They always did like things like that, and that is truly part of New Orleans culture. But on the other hand, that never interests my mother. So we were never exposed to it. We never did care for it. So I would say their culture didn't influence me at all. But then again, that's just the type of person I am.
And was your mother from New Orleans?
Yes.
Did she identify with any group, like Cajun or Creole?
No, my mother didn't, no, she didn't. But she was, my mother's father basically was biracial. Because my grandfather's father was a Frenchman. But his mother was a slave. And from what I understood, she worked for him when she had my grandfather. But my mother was just a black woman. She was high yellow. I guess the kind that if you would read any of the slave books, it would say she was a mulatto or mulatto, whatever they call them. But my mother was a black woman. On her birth certificate, it is black. And that's what she was. And no, she did not identify with no Creole or anything like that.
Would you say that the New Orleans culture has an effect on you now?
Not really. I know their culture. because like New Orleans is known for their foods. And like I said, their second lines and their jazz fest and things like that's what they're known for. And I don't see where none of that affects me. Personally. Because really, I guess it's because of how I was brought up. It just doesn't faze me. I wasn't introduced to it when I was a child. And I do remember one time when I was a teenager, I did try to participate in the carnival festivities. And the wild man who be with the Indians, you know, the Indians, there's a wild man who's supposed to follow the Indians. I remember that man ran behind me with a hatchet screaming, and he was drunk on Canal Street. And I ran from Canal Street, and I don't know when I stopped running. I'm sure the man had been stopped. I never looked back. And that was the first time I ventured out, and it was the last. I never participated in carnival anymore. Except, let me take that back. I'll retract it. My children, I introduced each one of them. I did introduce them to carnival. I would take them on carnival day to a parade, just so they would know and wouldn't feel left out. Because I did not want to not make my children aware of their surroundings. But none of them didn't like it either. And I was glad. I was very glad. And especially for the last couple of years when Mardi Gras, Carnival, whatever they want to call it, has changed. It, for the last 15, 20 years, it has turned into a vengeance thing where people, there's a lot of violence, and I'm glad my children never was into it. And as a matter of fact, as we speak, another reason I never wanted anything to do with that, because I did have a son who went to a parade, although I had told him not to go. And after following the parade, he was jumped by like 15 boys. And he was brought home to me by an off-duty police officer. And in turn, I had to bring him to the hospital. And that even made me more against carnival festivities. And, you know, far as the food cultures of New Orleans, I feel as if I cook better than any of them anyway. And then I'm not one. I'm not one for really eating out. So their food don't interest me either.
Can you talk more about the vengeance in Mardi Gras?
Well, the reason I'm saying vengeance is because it seems as though for the last couple of years, the young people really feel to believe if you want to get someone, that would be the opportune time. There's the crowds. You easily to do them something and get away with it. And if you go into any of our news, if you could pull up any news things, you'll see during carnival time, there's a lot of fights. Now, it's usually after the parades. It's not during the parades. But then again, that doesn't stop people. People who truly love carnival. It doesn't stop them because they really have a good time. Because the parades, the floats, they're beautiful. And the trinkets and stuff they throw, all that's fine. I have nothing against that for somebody else. It just don't do anything for me.
Can you tell us what you were when Hurricane Katrina struck?
Yeah, smart. Smart in my house. Got caught and had to go stay in my attic because my children asked me to leave prior. And I told them, nothing's going to happen. I'm going to run away. And they begged me to come. And they said, come on, Ma. I said, oh, no. They said, you're going to get caught in a hurricane. I said, baby, I'll ride the roof before I come with you. But I really thought nothing was going to happen. But it did.
So
I was stuck at my house.
And your children evacuated?
My children left, and my grandchildren.
Where did they go?
They went to Alabama. And I stayed home. Me and my husband. And my sister, she was on the West Bank. Her house is like flat to the ground. So she figured if something would happen, she knows she wouldn't have no safety net. So she came over to me. And as happens, nothing happened in our neighborhood. She came where all the danger was, which was my house. And I remember another reason we didn't know Katrina was coming like it was. She and I was laying in the bed, looking at the TV. She said, girl, turn that off. Tired of hearing all that. They like all that. They looking for something. They just dancing up some dances trying to get Katrina to come. And I said, turn that off. So we turned the TV off. So therefore, we didn't hear anything. I must have hit something. Therefore, we didn't hear the correct information that would have alerted us and really warned us that it really was coming. And we start regular girl talk like she and I talk and all kind of stuff, and we fall in all out laughing and everything. And my husband says, why are y'all not listening to the news? We told him if he want to hear the news, go out in the street and find news. Because we wasn't looking at no TV. So that was that. And all I know is we were laughing and talking, that passed. And she went in my bathroom. And there's a closet there once, you know, it had started raining. And she says, look, they say if you have the winds and the rains to get in a closet or a tub for safety. She said, this is my closet. And she took her purse. She said, this is my closet. You and your man go find, y'all go find y'all in the closet. So I was laughing at her. So I went in the kitchen. I don't know what I went back there for. But as I was coming back toward her, I felt the carpet was soaking wet. And I said, well, what happened here? Why is this carpet wet? And the minute I said that, water just rose. So I said, Colette, come out of the bathroom. She said, what am I coming out the bathroom for? I said, you mean you sit down there and you don't feel all that water on your buttocks? Except that's not the word I was using. And she said, oh, Lord! She got up. And by the time she got up, the water was like to our calf. So then my husband pulled down the stairs so we could go in the attic. And that's where we were. And the water came like to hear on me because of by me being so short.
In the house or in the attic?
No, in the house.
Okay.
No, in the attic there was nothing. You know, we were safe in the attic. And well, the good thing about my attic is it had perfect ventilation. The only drawback of my attic is my insulation and stuff from the air conditioning units and stuff. Central air units, because I didn't have a closet downstairs, so they all the stuff is in my attic, and you know that. But aside from that, my attic would have been perfect, and so we stayed in the attic. Now it's hard to believe. I really don't know how long I stayed there. I think it was think it was like overnight into the next day. But I guess some part of me was traumatized to the fact that I cannot remember exactly how long I stayed in the attic. But I knew I was going in that attic because in that water, you could see Earl. You could see all kind of stuff. And I just shook my head because that was 2005. And 2001, I had a house fire that had already destroyed my house. And my house was just put back together. So I had brand new furniture from front to back. And then Katrina came, and there it went again. I watched all my stuff floating, you know, all different kind of pots and accessories and stuff just floating, you know. So, but the fire had already prepared me for that. And the reason I said it prepared me for that, because it took everything I had away. So therefore, it didn't matter to me anymore. It's because I'm a person who I move on. And I don't relish things, because you can either get more things or something can happen to them that they're just things. So I really wasn't that hurt watching my stuff go. I was kind of peeved because I said, hey, I just spent all this time getting this, you know, and here we go again. I said, so what? You know, so it really didn't matter. So we stayed there, and when we did come out, we had to be saved by the military. They came with a boat, and it was about 12 or 13 other people in my neighborhood. We got on this boat. The boat took us to a little overpass where we got into the military trucks, you know, those big trucks. And they brought us to the Superdome where you had to check in, because everybody who went to that Superdome had to check in with their name, their address, their birth date, and their social security number. So somebody has a list. I don't know who, but someone has a list of everyone in that dorm, because that's the only way you could get in there. I want that list so that when I sue them, I can prove that I was in there. But anyway, we went to the Superdome. I don't know how long I stayed in there either. I stayed one night inside, because the rest I stayed outside. I couldn't take the odor and stuff. It was horrible inside the dorm by the time I got there. The toilets were not working. There was no water working. There was no air. There was limited lighting. There was everything you could name of in the bathroom and stuff on the floors. It was horrible. And my heart went out to the young women with the babies, because they had quite a few. And they had babies. And to have your babies in that condition was inhumane. And that's the part that really bothered me. It didn't bother me that bad with me being there as it was what I felt for these young people, you know. But from there, I stayed there, like I said, a day or two or something. I really don't remember, but I know my brother-in-law found us. We went over to my sister's house in Algiers. And from there, my daughter came and got me and her dad, because she's a paramedic, my daughter. So she was a first responder, so she could not leave anyway. Everyone else was mandated to leave New Orleans, but the first responders couldn't, so she could not leave. So her husband had brought her children earlier to Texas, and her husband and her took me and her dad to Texas, Austin, Texas. And that's where I stayed for 6 months. And within those 6 months, I had a son back here, and he took and got my house together. Of course, it was my retirement money that got my house back together. Because I worked, I forgot to say, I was a preschool teacher for 26 years. So I did have a retirement, and I took the retirement money. And so we stayed there 6 months. I came back here. I was supposed to be rehired, but that was a joke. I was not. But I was supposed to be rehired in social services because I do have a degree from Southern University in social welfare. And I was supposed to go that way, but I didn't go that way. So we got back in March 06. My husband died in October 06. He was already sick prior to the storm, but it really speeded his, he really couldn't deal with it. And that was something I didn't understand, because I always thought he was stronger than me, but when the deal went down, I was stronger than him. And he died. And after he died, I worked for City Hall for a little while for Healthy Steps. Still waiting to go back to the job I had, because I had been promised a job. I took physical and everything. So instead, I just continued to write my books, because I am an author, and I have written 5 books. I have a song that Nashville put to music for me that I'm trying to sell, but it is put to music. And I do have children books, but they're not published as of yet, because it really costs a lot to publish a child's book due to the illustration. And my daughter-in-law was the one who informed me that Common Ground was looking for a New Orleanian, someone who was an older person to work for them, to be able to have some type of comradeship with the residents of the Lower Ninth Ward. And so I applied. And I was hired in August. So on this job here, I do enjoy it. I get to meet several people. Matter of fact, a lot of people. Mostly college students. And I get to help residents. If it's no more than giving them information. Because the majority of what I do really is referrals. Because our job is contingent upon volunteers. And, you know, there are some things that they can do, but due to New Orleans strict laws of have to have so much stuff, sometimes things they can't do because they're not qualified. But, I mean, you know, they're not licensed or anything for certain things, but they can assist the homeowner into getting back into their homes in some kind of way. And that way I'm able to assist them. And that's what I do here. And like I say, I see a lot of college students. And most of them are Caucasian. And you only get a very few blacks. And sometimes I sit back and I wish there were more black girls who would go into education and be out here and be able to compete. Because when, just from what I've seen, you know, we're moving up to a certain extent, but, you know, plenty of the young girls, they're just not doing it. They're just not. And I really would like to see more young black girls. Because I believe at this time in your life, when you're 19 and 20 and stuff like that, you should be on the phone. You should be talking about going to Poland.
Yes.
You should be talking about what dress you want to wear, or if you want a tattoo. I don't think you should be trying to wonder what formula this baby's going to take, or if you're going to have to apply for welfare. Because you see, I've done the whole thing. I've done it all. I was a teenage mom. I was 18 when I had my first child. I was a welfare mom. I hated welfare. I couldn't wait to get a job to get off of welfare. I didn't like food stamps. Because it all put me, in my mind, in a begging attitude. And I'm the type of person, I won't beg for nothing. It's just how I am. I know man does not live by bread alone. I know as long as you're alive, you're going to need somebody. And I also know, which I found out later in years now, you learn this stuff with years. It's nothing that's taught to you in a book. But you need people. And how you treat people, it's going to come back on you. You treat people ugly, eventually you're going to run up against a lot of ugliness, because ugliness is all you know. And I know I would rather hold on to a memory any day than a grudge. And I wish the best for young people, all young people, black, white, green, or gray. But especially what I see, and what I see, young black girls need to be more into being self-sufficient. But not that self-sufficient that you feel to believe that everything is on you, because then it makes you matriarchal, and that's not what you're meant for either. That's why people have mates, to help them along the way. You don't have a mate to do it all yourself. And that has been a problem that I have noticed in a lot of black women. They do things themselves, and it's not meant for that. That's why it takes two people to come up with children. When you're married, that's two people being married. That's not one. But if you don't have education and you don't have inner morals, you're never going to experience the good things, because you're just going to be full of bad, sour things. And I say you live your life while you're young and do what young people do, because there's nothing like being older and realizing, or feel to yourself, you've let your youth go by. Because time is something, baby, you cannot reclaim. Under no circumstances. I don't care who you are. Rich or poor, you cannot reclaim time. And there's nothing like an old Mr. or Miss Young. Who could them old man make me sick? Y'all take that photo.
Well, Ms. Fletcher, we thank you for your time and for you sharing your story.
I remember somebody asked me before we start talking, my books. Lemonade was the first one. Fairy Tales and Secrets. Twisted, which was a sequel to Lemonade. Get In Where You Fit In. And the last one is Loose Change. That's my five books. Oh, I did have one other one. The very first book, but it wasn't published. I had copyright written, but I got a printer to print that one up. And that was a spiritual. And it was called Heartfelt. It had all spiritual poems in it. But that's six books that I did have out here that people could buy. All right, and y'all didn't ask me much questions. Y'all let me go talk on and on and on.